know, but there will be like, yeah. I think it's gravel.
Yeah, part of it. It will be, but yeah. Applicant's not here, so we don't need to do that. I don't think we have anybody that has any opponents, anybody neutral.
Thanks for running with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Tom and Missy aren't on there, are they? I don't think so. Nope. Ask if anyone wants to hold the hearing open, record open at this time. Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing. Do we have any additional questions for staff?
Casey, are there any limits to occupancy for the units? I mean, is there, mm-hmm. how many people can you put per trailer? Is there a limit on that, or is it just whatever's reasonable, or?
That's a great question. And as far as our conditions are phrased, we're only allowing it to be temporary workforce housing for individuals employed to construct the approved components of the facility. So I think theoretically, if a family wanted to come in and use this, I don't really see that being like a, I don't know. Like, I don't know that we would really have
And it's not typically done. I mean,
yeah.
These individuals are, each one has their own trailers. They work today and have their spaces with the...
But if they have it, if they're part of the family, yes. I don't think they would mind.
Yeah. We have one that had two or three kids.
Yeah. But they're not usually overloaded, I don't know.
No.
Historically.
The carrying capacity issue with septic is they're hauling their... It won't be a permanent facility.
And they're each bringing their own individual water, like they're supplying their own water to the RV. That's not like a water source or well, so it would make it, I think, challenging to have more than, I think, like a single occupancy RV. Mm-hmm.
So the individual employees or residents of these are bringing their own water?
The RVs usually have like a large water tank that you would fill up and then use it and then go.
Go filled up again?
Yeah, so, but I think that the workaround for that is, in addition to having a sewer pumper truck, they're going to have a water truck too, so they can
gotcha.
Fill up for showers and gray water. Probably not potable water.
Yes, it's mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if I want to. I do have a question. I assume they're going to have generators?
They're going to have electric connections, electric hookups.
Yeah, there's power right too.
Yeah.
There too, like.
But there won't be like a water hookup or septic hookup. It'll all be like,
self-contained.
Yeah, self-contained. That's it.
Any additional questions? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion.
I motion that we approve the conditional use permit submitted by Todd and Ms. Melissa Lindsay. Conditional N372-24.
Thank you. Second. The motion's been made and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion passed. Okay.
You're going to do your own PowerPoint.
Yeah, I think that's ready.
Alrighty. Now we are on to conditional use permit AZ-154.4, which is code updates, and that is Daisy and Tamara.
Daisy's the lead, I'm just a background.
Download it up at the top with those three dots. Downloads.
I just kind of like looking at Edge. Thank you, Chair. And I'll screen share. Okay, awesome. So this is the legislative action, the first legislative hearing for the code update that we discussed at our May work session. The primary purpose of this action is to clarify and codify our procedures and ensure that that the uses we're permitting fall into the appropriate buckets in line with state law. We went over a lot of the sort of nuances and like specific uses and specific changes and during our work session. So I'm gonna focus largely on the things that we've sort of clarified or changed since then. But a lot of those procedural questions, I think, can get really in the weeds. And so please stop me at any time if you have questions or if you just need clarification on something that I said. I updated this PowerPoint, but it's the same bones from what we saw during the May work session. But these eight buckets are the primary things that are being changed with this legislative amendment. The first one is that our administrative and ministerial processes were sort of intermingled in a lot of areas of our code, and it created a lot of confusion because a lot of the time people would just submit a zoning permit and then we would sort of make a staff decision about whether or not it required a legislative procedure or not. And we're going to get really in the weeds on this, but I want to make sure the Planning Commission understands the difference between administrative, which is what a lot of jurisdictions call a type 1 decision, and administrative is type 2, and a ministerial is a type 1 process. And then conditional use permits are a quasi-judicial process, and those are what come to the Planning Commission. The second one is clarity and consistency throughout the code. The third is amending the code enforcement section to be in line with our adopted code enforcement ordinance. The fourth is allowing the conversion of certain eligible existing dwellings on EFU land to become non-farm dwellings. The fifth is to specify vesting requirements and extension processes. The sixth is changing the comment period and appeal period, which we're making a few modifications from what you guys saw in May to our recommendation. The seventh is discussing the CUP process and the buckets in which we throw each of the specific uses in Article 3. And then eight is just sort of other, just different things that we're changing. Okay. So this is where we're going to get kind of in the weeds, and I want anyone to feel comfortable online or in person, like raising their hand and stopping me if I'm going too fast or if there's terminology or requirements that are a little bit convoluted, because sometimes I speak a little bit faster than my brain works. So ministerial decisions are not land use decisions as far as the state defines a land use decision. And this is really important because the way that the state defines a land use decision is that it has to go through a public process. At the very minimum, a type 2 decision has to go out for notice to neighboring property owners and affected agencies. And that's an administrative decision, so land use decision. And I think the easiest way to understand it is that type 3 or quasi-judicial decisions have a specific defined appeal period. So we send out notice to neighboring property owners, and they have an opportunity to come to you in a public hearing and state why they're aggrieved or why that project isn't meeting our standards. An administrative decision goes out for notice, and then there's a minimum 12-day appeal period. So if they disagree with the decision the Planning Commission makes, they can appeal to the Board of Commissioners and then to LUBA, which is the State Land Use Board of Appeals. The Type 2 decision, the administrative decision, also goes out for notice, but doesn't come to a hearing. And that, it's like a 12 to 21 day appeal period is applicable, but after that point, people can also come and say, oh, I was aggrieved and I never got notice, and there's a potential for them to have standing to appeal after that period. But a ministerial decision, because it's not a land use decision, if someone comes, you know, sees a development going in and they say, why didn't I ever get notice for that? That appeal period never started, and so there isn't a definitive, like, I think that ended can be up to 10 years in the future because there's no, there was never any notice, there's never any process, and so they can appeal it after the fact. And that's, I think, a really nuanced piece of the sort of type 1, type 2, and type 3 decisions, because our land use council always says you never err in providing too much process. So we could take a sign permit that could be done as a type 1 and send it to the Planning Commission, and we're not erring as the governing body by doing that. But if we take a development that was subjective and supposed to go through a higher process, and we do it through a lower process, we open ourselves up to those appeals even after whatever appeal period is defined in our code. So that was a little bit complicated. I don't think we really got into that too much in our May hearing, but I want to make sure that that's something that the Planning Commission understands. So let me know if there's any questions at this point.
Maybe it was a work session, just to clarify.
Yeah, sorry, a work
session. Yeah. Just so nobody thinks we had a hearing without providing
notice. Right.
And our county council, Dan Kearns, I just texted him. He's at another hearing, but he might be joining.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he isn't here yet.
Okay.
Okay.
That was good.
Thank you. So ministerial, no notice, administrative, notice, and quasi-judicial, notice and a hearing. And that's all broken out on this chart. As far as our actual process, there's a completeness period. We write findings. We send notice after we've already written findings, and then publish it in the newspaper, have a hearing, and the Planning Commission makes a decision. Administrative decisions, sort of the same process, but minus the hearing. And then ministerial decisions don't require any process. We make that decision internally. So zoning permits are ministerial permits. That this is the final step in any development process before they go out for a building permit. So if you're putting in a wind turbine, or you're putting in an accessory shop, or you're putting in a single family home, you need a zoning permit. And those are a type 1 decision. They're allowed outright. And the state requires that we only use clear and objective standards to review these permits. Because when you include subjectivity, when you put 10 people in the same room and they would come out with different interpretations, that's when we're required to send out notice so that we can hear how affected property owners or affected residents interpret those subjective standards. Additionally, we use zoning permits as the final step in our discretionary review process. So if anything goes through a conditional use process or a land use decision process, they always our conditions of approval always say applicant must receive zoning permit approval prior to receiving a building permit. And that's just to ensure that all of their conditions of approval are met and that their final plans that they're submitting to Glenn at the building department aren't totally whack different than what they already submitted. We also have to ensure that that zoning permit approval is done through clear and objective standards, even if the initial decision was discretionary. So we might be making a discretionary interpretation on their TIA is an important one, their mitigation, just things that get really complicated. But at the end of the day, those conditions of approval need to be clear and objective so that we can either check the box or not check the box and provide that final zoning permit approval.
Can I just add, great job, but and Daisy and I and Dan have gone over these terms laboriously. Daisy's doing a great job. I'll just pipe in. In some jurisdictions, they call a zoning permit zoning sign-off. Mm-hmm. And in Eastern Oregon, I don't know any jurisdictions who do it. We do it this way, right or wrong. So we've struggled with communicating that issue, even with our own county council. So that number two item that Daisy just explained, some jurisdictions call it like zoning clearance. We call it a zoning permit. It's like your certificate of occupancy from just your land use piece.
Yeah. Okay, any questions yet? Oh, I'm doing good.
Yeah, you are doing great.
So at this point, we want to discuss what bumps something up to that discretionary process, that type 2 process or administrative process. And this is a minimum procedure. So like we said before, there's those three levels, type 1, type 2, type 3, zoning permit, site plan review, and conditional use permit. And we have to provide at least that type 2 process for uses that have subjective standards or limitations. Development that requires a TIA, this one's pretty... Across the board, there isn't a jurisdiction that reviews TIA through a ministerial process. A TIA is extremely discretionary. It requires often a lot of back and forth between very technical experts, transportation engineers, like our public works director gets involved sometimes in negotiating mitigation, things like that. And because there's always subjectivity, you can throw a TIA out there and get 10 different people with 20 different ideas about the interpretation of those standards. So that across the board, there is a level of discretion to reviewing a TIA that requires at least a type 2 process. Another one that we included is development that uses municipal services outside of an urban growth boundary. And this is to ensure that we're meeting goal 11. There's a lot of like nuance that the state has about when you can provide water and sewer services outside of an urban growth boundary, and that's just to control the level of urban development that are in rural areas. Development within certain overlay zones, again, that just requires certain discretion based on our code. Development that includes new roads, again, it always requires a certain level of discretion. And then applications that include variances. Those are the ones that we've identified as needing to require, again, at least that type 2 process. So that's what I've included in my PowerPoint in terms of the process piece. And so does anyone have any questions so far? Awesome. Okay, the next piece is language consistency and clarity. We've already kind of harped on this with the last one. A big one that we've identified is that there are areas in our code that mention the 100-acre site development review trigger. That's something that we eliminated a while ago. That's just sort of a holdover, so we're eliminating that where it's mentioned in Article 3. And then a few other random ones like Secretary of the Planning Commission or County Court instead of Board of Commissioners. So we're just cleaning that up. So the next piece is clear and objective language. And this plays on the discussion about the ministerial versus administrative process. So in order, again, to process something ministerially, it has to be through clear and objective standards. Once you throw in anything like, this is in Article 3 in the MG zone, rather than having an objective lot size standard, our code currently just says the minimum lot size has not been determined for the zone, and it must be a size necessary to accommodate the proposed use. However, it's anticipated that most, if not all, uses shall be on lots of at least 2 acres. The determination of lot size will be driven by the carrying capacity of land and the proposed use. So that is a subjective standard. And based on the state's requirements for ministerial review, anything in the MG zone based on this would have to put up to a type 2 decision. Because again, the idea of carrying capacity or necessary to accommodate the proposed use, those are subjective terms that would have to be provided some level of public process. Another example is just our terminology where we have in some zones, like I think this is the MG zone, instead of saying there's like our code defines utility facilities necessary for public service and a few other utility related definitions, but in this zone it just says utility facilities, which can mean a lot of different things and can be subject to 10 different interpretations. So we're just changing it to make sure that it's specific and it's defined in our code. Okay. Another example is extensions. So the way our extension provisions are worded right now in our code, it requires that the applicant has to state reasons that prevented the applicant from being beginning or continuing development within the approval period, and the county determines the applicant was unable to begin or continue development. Again, subjective standards, so we're replacing it by just saying that the code applicable to the original development has not changed, and they've submitted their request prior to the expiration period. So that just makes it a lot simpler. That 10 people in the same room are going to see that and say, okay, we know whether the code's changed, and we know whether the expiration date's passed. So those are a few examples, and there's a few other things that fall under those buckets in our code update. This one's easy. We're just basically taking out what we currently have that is just different than our code enforcement ordinance and referencing the code enforcement ordinance instead. It's a lot of the same stuff, but some things that are just worded differently. So to avoid confusion, we're making that consistent. we're clarifying the extension investing requirements. So our intent is that anyone can come in and apply for an extension, and the director can grant it under clear and objective standards as long as the code provisions haven't changed. The way I have it worded now, we're only allowing like one extension based on the director's decision. But if the code hasn't changed, that was some feedback we got, like why would we have to go through the process again? So it's up to the Planning Commission, and we can do sort of a vote on that if you guys would like to extend that more than the one time. We can do like a limit, or we can just say indefinitely, as long as the code's the same, you can keep getting extensions. But the vesting piece there is that once you, so if you have a land use decision, you have a site plan review or a conditional use permit, you need to come back in and get that zoning permit prior to building permit approval. So the question is, okay, if I've got a zoning, or I've got a land use decision, and I've extended it for like 3 years, and I want to come back and get my zoning permit, but the code has changed with regard to my original approval, do I need to go back through and get a land use decision? Well, actually, we've decided land use decisions are vested once your zoning permit is granted. So your zoning permit is reviewed under the zoning permit criteria, and your land use decision is reviewed under the site plan review criteria. And if your site plan review is granted, you can get the zoning permit as long as your conditions have been met and the zoning permit approval criteria have been met. And then that zoning permit is vested when the building permit is granted. So if it takes longer to get that building permit, you can still go past that 1 year. So does that make sense? Okay. So we're changing the process on administrative review a little bit. And this is something that we also want to get Planning Commission feedback on, because in most, so how we currently do it with the administrative process is there's a 30-day completeness period. We deem an application complete. We send out a tentative decision with findings, and then we provide a 21-day comment period. If a hearing's requested, then we would send out an additional notice of the public hearing. If not, it's final after that appeal period is over, and we send the final decision, and then there's a 15-day appeal period. Statutorily, we don't have to do that middle piece. We only need to do the appeal period, and that appeal period can be as short as 12 days. So,
for the request for hearing.
The appeal period can be as short as 12 days. But we have sort of two options for the Planning Commission to consider. So the first one is what most jurisdictions do, which is to issue a notice of application before we even write findings. We send it out to neighboring property owners and agencies, and then we give them like 14 days or 12 days to provide feedback, request a hearing, or request additional information. And then if we don't receive any comments, we send out a final notice of decision, and then there's a 15-day appeal period, or again, it can be a 12-day appeal period or longer. A second option would be to, which is how it's worded right now in the update, would be to just consolidate that comment period and appeal period and provide a longer appeal period. But again, it can be as short as 12 days. So we have a lot of discretion there on what we want to do. I was hoping to get sort of a vote from the Planning Commission on whether you think it's worthwhile to consolidate those two, leave it the way it is, or provide the two-step notice of application, comment period, and then notice of decision and appeal period.
So we go back, what was it? We go back page?
Yeah.
Okay. So this one, what you're saying is a majority of the state is following, this is how, mm-hmm. You could say that our neighboring Umatilla County, yep. Gillam, Wasco, this is the part there, most likely.
This is how, yeah, most of
so that would make
not
it.
Not Umatilla County, but.
We'll think that okay. out. But as the most part, you're looking at this is the structure that a lot of planning going, and it's going through fine, whether the state agrees with it. I personally think this one is, option is, that's just my opinion. I feel that as long as you've made the notice of application, you guys have went through, it fits your, you know, fits into the protocols that it's supposed to, I don't see why we need the additional
reinventing the wheel.
Just out of curiosity, okay. How often do you get feedback when you send out things?
Maybe 20% of the time. Like the applications we had today, we got a comment letter from Boardman, nothing on the Lindsays, nothing on Landon's. Kind of depends on the scale of the prep. So everything we do, almost everything we do in an EFU zone, I'd say 80% of the time we don't get anything.
I wouldn't scale it back to 12 days, though, because you have people who go on vacations for 2 weeks, and we actually had that happen with one of our vacated streets, so,
ooh,
yeah.
Good comment.
I personally like making sure people are aware and giving opportunity as much as possible, so I'm not opposed to following the rest of the state, I guess, either, but I also don't mind being unique.
Would it be okay for us to do an informal vote on if everyone's okay with that? What I'm hearing is maybe doing like a 14-day notice of application and then a 14-day appeal period. That's
the request for a hearing period. Right?
Yeah, so yeah. 14-day request for hearing comment period and then a 14-day appeal period. And that would be my preference, because then it's 2 weeks. There's not like the 12 and 15 days often end up on a weekend. So like it's more straightforward, I think, to do 14. Does anyone object to that, I guess?
I think I'd be more comfortable with that.
Okay. That sounds.
I had a question about the, if a hearing is requested, an additional notice of public hearing is sent out, how would they know that there was a hearing unless a notice was sent out? Like if you were a concerned party.
Yeah, that it would definitely, if a public notice is or if a public hearing is requested, we would send out that second notice. It would go out as if it were a public, just like any other public hearing. Mm-hmm. We'd follow that process.
We'd follow that quasi-judicial process.
Okay, so then why are we striking that part if a hearing is requested and an additional notice is sent out?
That would be actually not struck with the recommendation we just proposed. That was. So the current code version that we've submitted just consolidates those two processes. So it actually would not include us issuing a notice of application. It would just skip all of that and send out a notice of decision. And then someone would have to submit an appeal in order to request a hearing, which is a very minimum process that the state would require. But it sounds like the commission's leaning towards offering that initial opportunity to request a hearing.
Just my two bits worth. I like Daisy's idea a lot, and what I didn't like initially is that you're sending a notice of an application with really much of anything to chew on, but that gets the ball rolling for the applicant. Yeah. And then we get feedback, and then we can write the findings. So really, this really has the real potential to expedite it without truncating the public involvement piece.
Yeah, I think it's in line with our quasi-judicial process. Like we don't provide findings when we do our notice of hearing. We just provide a really general, brief description of what the decision's about or what they're requesting and where it's located and what criteria we're using to evaluate it. So it would be just in line with our quasi-judicial process as well.
And you put that in paper, the public hearing notice, or?
Yeah, if a public hearing is requested, it would go out in the paper just like any other quasi-judicial process.
But not the administrative review?
Yeah.
Right. That's why right here it says 15-day appeal period. It's the request for a hearing. There's a maximum statutory limit. You can't charge more than $250. That's from like 30 or 40 years ago, or 50 maybe. I don't know. And that means that you're not creating a barrier for public involvement for people wanting to say, let's have a full, quasi-judicial vetting with your planning commission.
Okay, that's my question. Okay.
Yeah.
So with the 14 days in there on each end, it gives people the opportunity to say something or make a comment without being charged.
Absolutely. The earlier notice, for sure, they can call and ask a lot of questions.
I like that better.
Give us input. And then from that, we would write our we're going to call it a final decision, or that decision becomes final at the end of that 14th day, or whatever day you choose.
So I will, based on any public comments we hear at the end of the staff report, but it sounds like the planning commission is leaning towards changing the recommended language to be a 14-day contract and a 14-day appeal period. So that's covered there. So this piece, I think, is second to last, so we're almost done. But the conditional use permit process, this is something that the planning commission addressed when the administrative review process was initially adopted, was sort of taking a lot of the conditional use permit stuff and moving it to that type 2 review, essentially, that it doesn't need to go in front of a planning commission, doesn't need to be a quasi-judicial thing. Common types of CUPs we see are home occupation permits, residential uses in commercial zones, renewable energy facilities in farm and forest zones, aggregate mining operations, and then like all the weird stuff, right? So golf courses in residential zones, like sewage treatment facilities, personal use airports and EFU, like hospitals, mobile home parks. And so our intent, and this was submitted supplementally because I think it wasn't included in the original update, but we want to go back through our zoning districts and actually break that out. So right now, most of our zoning permits, or most of our zones, but not all, have a uses permitted outright and then uses permitted subject to zoning or CUP approval. And so what my proposal is to throw in a third category and say, these are uses specifically subject to administrative review or site plan review. So this would, I think it's really clear in our like EFU zone, for example, because those are mostly statutorily defined as to whether it's a type 1, type 2, or type 3 process. But some of our other zones are a lot more open to interpretation, and it's up to the Planning Commission to determine which bucket those uses go into. So when you look at like a hospital in the SR zone, I think it's appropriate for that to be a hearing, like in front of the Planning Commission. Whereas if you're looking at something that's less intensive, it can be done through an administrative review. Say like an automobile wrecking yard was one of them that was identified in 3.070, which is NG, general industrial. That's something that staff can review through clear and objective, or not clear and objective, but through the administrative process. Thank you. Lumber and wood products manufacturing. So I did my best to break them out in our estimation of what an appropriate process is, but as a general rule, if you're going to put 10 people in a room and they're going to come out generally around the same lines, we should be doing it as a type 2. But if you're going to put 10 people in the same room and they're all going to have different interpretations, that should probably be a conditional use. Okay, so this is the final slide, and these are just sort of the random things that we're also including in this update. Conversion of an existing farm-related dwelling. We dug into this a little bit during the work session, but we're recommending that in line with Umatilla County standards, we can allow, like say a retired farmer can turn his farm dwelling into a non-farm dwelling, and then they're not subject to all of the stringent like income farm income requirements and soil. That's a little complicated, but as long as they meet these provisions, it can be turned into non-farm dwelling, and they often will do that for estate planning, so they can sell off that house. Accessory structures. This is just one that the Board of Commissioners adopted standards for shipping containers. And this, I think, is important to note because the way that they adopted this very specific language, no more than, some of these I added in, I think, I put in no more than 2 shipping containers on a single lot because I felt like that was reasonable. But the ones that the Board of Commissioners felt strongly about were that it has to be painted to visually conform with the surrounding local environment, and that improvements need to conform to all local and state building codes. So that third piece there, that needs to be painted to visually conform with the surrounding local environment, that's subjective. And so based on that, whenever someone comes in for a shipping container, that's going to have to go to a type 2 notice. And it's not, I mean, with something like this, it's pretty straightforward. You send it out for notice, you respond to these 4 criteria in a set of findings, and you send it out. And so it's not a huge lift, but it's just sort of as a way to frame this, when you start thinking about objective standards versus subjective standards, we would, legally speaking, be required to send this out for notice because 10 different people might come away with a different interpretation of what visually conforming with the surrounding local environment means. And then this final piece that we adopted was a recommendation from UEC that, or it started from that, and we actually did a lot of research to see how other jurisdictions handle it, but their concern was that if they're an entity with the power of eminent domain and they have a property owner that is not working with them, or they need to go through like the eminent domain process, as like sticky as that is and as much as we don't like to be involved in those processes, they've pointed out that their processes are going to be super, super protected. They need to actually get a signature from that person, from that person's hand, right? So our compromise, their initial recommendation was that we just say that applicants with a power of eminent domain have a blanket exemption from property owner signatures. We said no. This is our compromise, is to say if you provide a resolution of public necessity indicating that you actually do intend to exercise your statutory authority to condemn the property, that is enough evidence for us to process the application without having to be the mediator of a property conflict.
And it takes quite a bit for them to get to that process, so that seemed like a pretty good compromise. But your thoughts about that would be helpful as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you might want to say, no, our current process, like the Public Utility Commission, the court has to say, yeah, you have the right for eminent domain.
I like that. I personally like that. I mean, as terrifying as it has been in Boardman over the last few years, I don't know. I mean, as a landowner, how do you feel about giving up your rights outside of a court? I mean,
That's fair feedback. That's why we put it up there for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, a signature. I mean, you could be forced to sign something. How are they getting that signature? Is it under duress? What are the criteria for getting the signature?
Our intent is that it's, that's just our way of saying, we don't want to, again, be like mediating property disputes. We want that to be settled as through, you know, between the parties. And in order to be as objective as possible, we felt like this was a fair middle ground. But that alternative would be you have to actually have gone through the entire eminent domain process, and now you are the legal owner of that property or that sliver of property, and then you can come in and sign yourself, right? So I think that that is an extremely protracted process that can take years for good reason, right? And this was just our understanding of like a fair middle ground for that process to play out without...
Define fair.
Yeah, because, right.
I mean, that's not really fair. So, I mean, at any point, somebody's declaring eminent domain of your property, there's no fairness involved there. So I don't know. I'm just gonna drop it.
This is super good feedback. So, you know, we took all those comments that we've been receiving starting last fall when we started this process and when we started it again, and you know, we threw this in the mix, and if you want to keep the current language, we can sure do that.
Daisy, could you put in there before the word if the applicant is an entity, could you put after the applicant has completed the judicial process to be granted eminent domain, then?
We wouldn't really even need that because mm-hmm. they would then own title to the property.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you guys would want the whole process to have played out prior to them being able to initiate the land use process, then we would just strike that completely and keep it the way it is, that it's the property owner signature.
Of record. Mm-hmm. Does that seem like a consensus from the Planning Commission?
Mm-hmm. Me, I'd like to speak for myself.
Yes, that sounds desirable.
Thank you.
I would agree.
Okay.
I'm touching.
I am curious, even if I go back just one to the accessory structures, I'm just curious how they approved shipping containers is something they're okay with on property. This is a Board of Commissioners meeting, right?
Yeah, this is a while ago. I think it was like 2018. And it's something we have been providing findings, or at least approving them.